organizing a French language activity for youth in your community? The VIF program can make it happen. You could receive $850 to create your activity, and your partnering organization could get $150 to support it. Bring your idea to life. Visit proclamvif.ca and apply today.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie on Kingston City Council's approval of a temporary lease extension for the Linehearts Laundry Program following the closure of the Adelaide Street Shelter.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. While the Adelaide Street Shelter at 38 County Street is winding down and will close on March 31st, Council voted at their last meeting to allow for a short-term extension of Linehearts Incorporated's lease for the organization's vocational laundry program to continue. The daytime employment-focused program currently employs 8 individuals and provides laundry services to shelters and care providers across the city. The program is set to move to 309 Queen Mary Road and become part of the integrated services at the new transitional housing site. However, the location is still currently under construction. The extension for the laundry program to remain in the former Frontenac Public School building aims to prevent disruption until the new location is ready. The extension allows for up to an additional 6 months, starting April 1st. Linehearts CEO Travis Blackmore spoke before council and stressed the impact of this program and the importance of it continuing without disruption.
This is about maintaining something that already works, supporting people in a practical, dignified way, helping partner organizations operate efficiently, and doing so without adding pressure to the system. Importantly, allowing the program to remain in place creates no additional impact to the surrounding community beyond what already exists today. This is not a long-term request. It is a short-term practical step to ensure continuity while permanent location is finalized. It allows us to transition responsibly without disruption to individuals, partners, or the broader system. Our program has been, in our view, very successful in terms of seeing them acquire housing. Some of them move on to acquire their own housing, so not just through Linehearts transitional housing, but acquire their own housing. Some of which have come through the program since 2022. So it's got a proven track record. How it affects the broader community is we have a number of contracts with some local shelters to which we offer the laundry service, pickup, cleaning, delivery back. But you have 8 potential people that it could impact, coming already from their past and struggles, many of them off the street already, but again have gone forward to a brighter future, a brighter path forward, and this is a big piece to their puzzle or their life story.
While it is confirmed shelter services will not be continuing after March 31st, residents in the neighborhood surrounding the site still had concerns about Linehearts continuing to operate from the location. A petition was presented to council from 88 residents around the Adelaide Street Shelter that asked the city not to renew or extend any further contracts with Linehearts at the location after March 31st for any reason. One of these residents came to speak before council on the issue.
The entire Adelaide Street shelter has been a prime example of what not to do when opening, operating, extending, and now winding down an emergency shelter. Our neighborhood, our city budget, and most importantly, the people Lionhearts was supposed to shelter and serve have endured more than enough from Lionhearts.
Councillors questioned Blackmore in regards to these community concerns.
I just want to acknowledge some concerns that we've heard from community members. I just want to ask you if you could confirm something for me. So can you please confirm that if this extension for laundry is granted, that the building is only going to be used for laundry services and it will only be for staff members that you have hired? It won't be for guests, it won't be for visitors, it will not be a spot to hang out. Can you confirm that, please?
I can confirm that 100%. Just for staff, just to do the laundry contracts. That's, it's a 9 to 5, basically.
And the residents in the area have asked that you move faster. Can you?
There is, if Queen Mary Road is ready on the 1st, we'll be in there. If it's ready on June 1st, we'll be there too.
When it came time to vote on the extension, Councillor Gregory Ridge pointed to the message received from neighbours of the site.
I have had a number of very long discussions with constituents that live around the Adelaide Street shelter. We've heard some of those concerns this evening around how the operations have gone there or how they've affected the people that are living there. I think it's important to try and make that distinction. And the message that I've received from constituents is very clear in terms of the petition, in terms of it, which is that they just do not want that management to continue in that space, even with the laundry program.
However, Councillor Gary Osteroff pointed to the impact this program has for those employed and the city's network of services.
The value that's going to be given to those involved in the vocational training and how it benefits the vulnerable in our community. And I think we might be taking our laundry for granted at home, that we really should not, because it does give a lot of dignity and self-worth and for the givers and the receivers here, and we can be part of the giving here.
With a vote of 10-3, the city will enter into a lease agreement with Lionhearts for the use of 38 County Street for vocational laundry services for not more than 6 months, commencing April 1st. Following the expiry or termination of the lease with Lionhearts, the city will move forward with the demolition of the former Frontenac Public School building. With the end of shelter services just a few days away, Councillor Gregory Ridge asked Blackmore about lessons learned from the Adelaide shelter.
My one question for you is, looking at this entire scenario with the Adelaide Street shelter in the space, is there one piece that you could point to that you would be a lesson for any organization running a shelter space or any service for the vulnerable that you've learned from this?
It's tough. I think every organization out here would say more funding. You feel like you're putting Band-Aids on issues and trying to triage as best as you can, but you're equipped with Band-Aids. I know funding across the board is an issue for any agency whatsoever. That's what I would say, more funding and changing hearts and minds to really understand the issues of everything you've heard tonight, whether it was the CTC pieces. It's hearts and minds toward actual real human beings and seeing them at one point and wanting them to be restored to some extra afforded purpose, maybe some extra dignity for their life, and realize they're a human being.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forstell, LJR reporter for The Kingstonist, about funding cuts that leave the Kingston Native Centre and Language Nest's services at risk.
Thank you, Dinah. Federal funding changes set to take effect Wednesday, April 1st, 2026, could significantly limit the Kingston Native Center and Language Nest's ability to support the city's urban Indigenous population, unless the decision is reconsidered. According to a release, the impact won't be abstract for those who rely on the center. The Kingston Native Center and Language Nest, KNCLN, which opened in 2023, is part of a network of Indigenous-run friendship centers that provide cultural programming and frontline social supports in communities across Ontario, reflecting the reality that over 50% of Indigenous people in Canada now live in urban areas. The funding being reduced is not tied to a single program. It forms the operational backbone that enables friendship centers to function, supporting everything from cultural programming in schools and weekly programming rooted in traditional craft and cuisine, to mental health navigation and housing support for people experiencing homelessness. Without it, organizations like KNCLN say they will be forced to scale back. These cuts undermine trust that has taken time to build, said KNCLN Executive Director Brandon Markle. When funding disappears, community members don't experience it as a line item. They experience it as the center no longer being able to help their grandmother, their children, or their family. At the core of the issue is the Federal Urban Programming for Indigenous Peoples, UPIP, Fund, administrated by Indigenous Services Canada. The program's budget is being reduced by $240 million, from $267.5 million to only $27.5 million, an almost 90% reduction, leaving Ontario's 31 friendship centers to share just $5.8 million this year. But federal documents frame the change differently. In materials describing the program, the government emphasizes its ongoing commitment to supporting urban Indigenous communities, describing UPIP as a program that helps fund services and partnerships across the country. At the same time, internal briefing notes confirm that the recent increase in funding was temporary, a two-year enhancement introduced in the 2024 federal budget. That enhancement allowed friendship centers to operate with what many describe as adequate funding for the first time in decades. KNCLN staff noted, however, that because the center opened in 2023 during that funding window, it has never operated under the lower long-term funding model now being reinstated. Under the new scenario, not only is the temporary enhancement disappearing, the center's remaining core funding is being cut by more than half. The uncertainty alone has caused me a great amount of sense, Markle said. Without stable funding, we can't plan responsibly or guarantee that the services people rely on every day will continue. Advocates say the situation reflects a deeper issue. Funding for urban Indigenous services has been long structured as a short-term or project-based rather than stable and needs-based. In Kingston, where City Council has formally committed to advancing reconciliation through its 2023-2026 strategic plan, the center plays a key role in bridging systems that often fall short for Indigenous residents. Staff deliver in-school cultural programming, they support clients navigating mental health systems, and they provide culturally safe assistance for those facing homelessness and posing instability. The center has also been expanding its reach, including partnerships like a recent collaboration with Queen's Law to improve access to Indigenous legal services. When that capacity shrinks, the effects don't stay within the organization. According to Markle, they ripple outward. He expects the cuts to the center will place additional strain on already stretched local systems, from housing to healthcare. Recent funding decisions affecting other community services in Kingston have raised similar concerns, with local organizations warning that uncertainty can quickly ripple through frontline supports, including impacts outlined in Kingstonists' recent coverage of provincial cuts to consumption and treatment services that potentially impact local services. Federal messaging emphasizes support, but it does not directly address the scale of reductions facing friendship centers. Instead, the changes are described as the end of temporary funding and a transition to a revised program model. For organizations on the ground, that distinction offers little reassurance. Being left in limbo creates chaos, Markle said. The Ontario Federation of Indigenous Friendship Centers has called on the federal government to work collaboratively with friendship centers to develop a stable, long-term funding model, one that reflects actual operating costs and preserves the gains made during the recent funding increase. For KNCLN, the issue isn't just what it lost immediately, it's what cannot be built. Markle explained that decisions at the center are guided by seven-generation stewardship, a long-term approach rooted in care, continuity, and responsibility to future generations. Relationship building takes time. Stability matters. Sudden funding changes, he said, can undo that work quickly, shifting the consequences onto the future leaders and generations. These aren't short-term impacts, Markle said. They shape what our children inherit. For the people who depend on those services, the distinction between a cut and program shift may matter less than the result. We are asking the federal government to reconsider, Markle said. More information on the Kingston Native Center and Language Nest can be found on the KNCLN website.
Thank you, Henry, and to Michelle Dory Forstell of the Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, LJR reporter for CJPE County FM in Picton, on the Affordable Housing Corporation's updates to Prince Edward County Town Council.
What is affordable housing? Ontario's definition is a cost that does not exceed 30% of a household's gross annual income. Considering the price of housing in Prince Edward County and the fact that many residents struggle to attain employment that pays above minimum wage, it seems there is no affordable housing. In 2019, the municipality created the Prince Edward County Affordable Housing Corporation to address the needs, and to date, $750,000 has been invested, but there is still no affordable housing. Some councillors and their constituents are losing faith and question the investment. Tuesday night, councillors St. Jean and Nyman took the podium to explain the situation, and as board chair and vice chair, they have invested heavily with their time. Councillor St. Jean wants the public to understand the difficulties securing government grants for rural areas, the time it takes, the environmental requirements, and the process to acquire the appropriate land. Councillor Phil St. Jean tells us more. Councillor St. Jean, you and Councillor Nyman gave very detailed information about the Affordable Housing Corporation and what's happening with it. Can you talk about what you would like the public to know?
Specifically, it's not about so much the two projects that we're currently working on. It's about the information to help people to understand what it takes to build affordable and attainable housing. The challenges, whether it be financial, the cost of building, or more importantly, the challenges that every developer, and make no bones about it, we're a developer of affordable housing, that we all face. And in this case, it's whether it's soil remediation on a site that doesn't quite meet the standards for residential housing, or even the various levels, because every property before you build on it has to have an environmental site assessment done. You typically have to have hydrogeological studies done. There's a long list of studies that need to be done to prove that the land is safe to build on. And I think a lot of members of the public, and I didn't know much about this until I got into this position, they don't understand the depth and breadth of issues that you can run into and the challenges that you can face to get it done, and the timelines. As we presented in the one slide deck, it can take, on average, not maximum, average 56 months to get to the point where people are moving into a place. If you do traditional builds, not modular, you can add another 18 months to that. So that's the information, I believe, that all of the public needs to know. That, and I also want their support to help us to build affordable and attainable housing, as Councillor Pinnell suggested. Fundraising and donations would be great.
And the grants that you apply for, it takes a very long time, and then, you know, you may or may not get them.
Yes, absolutely. It does take a lot of time. There's a lot of background work, and the required studies that I mentioned, those are all part of those applications. You have to be able to prove to a lender or a grantor that their money is going to the right place. So all of those standards, all of those studies, all of those requirements, they tie into your grant funding and even your loan applications, because nobody will lend you money for dirty land. You have to prove that it is clean and ready to go. It's a passion project. But it's a passion project that we're willingly walking into with our eyes wide open and our minds wide open to try to figure out how can we do this to better serve the people in our community that they need affordable housing, they need attainable housing.
You have some pretty impressive people on this committee. Can you tell me about them?
Well, yes, we do have a very impressive board. When we did a call out, I believe it was in October of last year, we had specific requirements that we were looking for, people with planning skills, development skills, nonprofit housing skills, and generally a good understanding of building and our community. And we got that with each and every one of the new board members, Penny Morris, Ted Elborn, Hillary Spriggs, and Mark Guslis. And they are all, you know, they've rolled their sleeves up and they dived in to make sure that they're contributing in a big way. And I've said it a number of times to fellow councillors and members of the public, since they came on board, their first meeting was in November, we've achieved so much in 4 months, less than 4 months, far more than and this isn't to take away anything from previous board members, just the ball finally started rolling for us. Instead of pushing it uphill, it's now running downhill, and we're chasing it, and we're excited to be in the game.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Up next, CFRC's Juliana Gonsalves is reading a story by Sarah Williams, LJR reporter for the Napanee Beaver, on Bath Artisan's upcoming spring art show and sale.
Thank you, Dinah. Since 1991, the Bath Artisans have been at the epicenter of creativity within and around the community of Bath. The Bath Artisans 2026 Spring Art Show and Sale returns April 25th and Sunday the 26th from 10 to 4 p.m. The event will take place at St. John's Hall in Bath. The group's mission is to promote interaction among members by sharing knowledge while encouraging members working in diverse mediums. Another key component of their mission is to support the display and sale of creative pieces in both local and remote venues. The Bath Artisans have a current membership of 32 people, including watercolorists, acrylic and oil painters, woodworkers, jewelry makers, fused and stained glass artists, glass painters, fiber artists, sculptors, card makers, and photographers. There are 17 artists taking part in the upcoming show and sale, representing a varied selection of paintings in oil, acrylic, watercolor, and mixed media. Some artisans create handmade cards, hand-painted alcohol ink tiles, and more. One thing is for sure, the spring show and sale promises something for every taste and every budget. Once again this year, there will be a draw for two pieces of art, one for each day of the show. Tickets are $3 for $5, and one winner will be drawn at the end of each day. All money raised will go to the local Lions Club to help support their three district food banks. In these uncertain, financially challenging times, this support is needed more than ever. For more information, visit www.bathartisans.info/mayshow.
Thank you, Juliana. Coming up now is Ted Evans, LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, on Loyalist Township Council's approval of an amendment to a zoning bylaw to permit the Windsor to house an alternative health facility.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township Council approved an amendment to a zoning bylaw that will permit the Windsor in Amherst View to house an alternative health facility and add additional site-specific provisions, including more parking. This matter has come back to council multiple times and has now been approved. Kingston Health Sciences Center also made a presentation about the facility at the meeting. Executive Director for Patient Care and Deputy Chief Nursing Executive with Kingston Health Sciences Center, Tom Hart, spoke about the feedback they received and the work they've done since.
Of course, we take our role very seriously. And after the council meetings and public feedback, we had a KHSC senior leadership debrief on the feedback from both the public and the council. And we were already taking action to try and alleviate some of those concerns. So we've engaged a real estate agent to try and look for parking options. We've worked with the owner of the home to try and arrange a shuttle for employees to alleviate some of the parking congestion. We've asked that the owner of the home commit to having a stop sign prior to the sidewalk, which they have committed to do.
Hart noted the type of activities that go on in the building and how their partnership with Loyalist Township can move forward.
All activity within the building is regulated, supervised, and aligned with provincial health policy and the Public Hospitals Act. We have a robust governance, safety, and operational controls in place. And of course, they're subject to continuous monitoring and improvement. Our commitment to the community and council, KHSC, we have a very long history and proud history of collaboration with our municipal partners, and we are very committed to transparency and ongoing dialogue, and we have respect for the local concerns along with our regional health obligations. We are certainly open to input on additional safeguards and operational adjustments and very willing to work with council and the public to strengthen assurances and comfort level.
Residents came forward again with concerns about on-street parking and public safety.
It's just a kind of a concern of being bullied. I don't feel as a member of the street that they are equal neighbors to us, and their initial plea to amend the Residential Uses Act and have themselves considered residences when it's primarily a temporary facility is, bad form and bad taste.
This small infill subdivision of ours has gone through a lot. We finally had our developer finish the work, and there was a lot of problems with that developer. Now we have this Windsor thing. We have the school ongoing. It's 250 meters of road, but it seems a lot of the development and a lot of the problems are in this one area. And as residents, we're constantly being bombarded by this.
The Windsor had already been housing the alternative health facility before they received official approval from council. They will now provide 64 on-site parking spaces, an increase of 13 spaces from what was initially proposed, and an increase of 30 spaces from what exists today. Councillor Paul Proderick noted residents' concerns.
We've had lots of presentations. I think the views of the populace along Park are fairly clear. The parking issue, the school, construction, all these different things, it's like the residents have been bombarded for X number of years. And I'm hoping that we can develop a parking through the staff, some kind of parking zoning commitment to whatever that alleviates some of that stress. And that further down the road, when the building across the street is finished, we might look at a more permanent solution to some of the stresses on Park Street, because we all know when it was built, the entrance to the old church was there, but certainly it was a different once a week type thing. And having been a member of that parish, we didn't fill the parking lot very often. So I can appreciate what the residents have said. Our hands are tied in terms of legislation, Ontario Land Tribunal, and this is the best result of for the residents, a situation that is challenging at best.
Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend assured residents they're doing all that they can.
We want the public on Park to know that we've heard them. And that we are doing what we can within the limited tool set that we have to try and address those concerns meaningfully.
Councillor Mike Buderick showed his confidence in staff coming up with a viable solution.
We will have an adequate solution proposed by staff. I can guarantee that.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
And thank you to Ted Evans for that story, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region. And coming up for Tuesday night weather, we've got showers with a low plus 2. On Wednesday, we'll see cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers and a high plus 8. Cloudy periods and a low minus 3 on Wednesday night. On Thursday, we'll see a mix of sun and cloud with a 60% chance of rain showers or flurries and a high plus 4. On Thursday night, we'll have cloudy skies with a 60% chance of showers and a low minus 1. And on Friday, we'll have cloudy skies with a 60% chance of showers and a high plus 10. Friday night, cloudy with a 40% chance of showers and a low plus 5. And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. The Office of VP Research offers undergraduate students meaningful opportunities to engage in discovery-based learning and to develop research and presentation skills through their Undergraduate Student Summer Research Fellowship and the Undergraduate Student Research Award. Do you self-identify as a Black or Indigenous person? There are allocated funds through the USRA to help address the disproportionate underfunding of Black and Indigenous scholars at the undergraduate level. All projects are paid full-time work under the guidance of a faculty researcher and run from May through August. Application intake and deadlines are set by each department, so contact your department supervisor today. Application intake and deadlines are set by each department, so contact your department or supervisor today. Access the website to learn more, queensu.ca/VPR/resources/undergraduate. For general inquiries, contact Tracy Allen at allent@queensu.ca.
Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you missed the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Dr. Silvia Pinheiro, who is doing research under the supervision of Dr. Valerie Kuhlmeier. Welcome to Grad Chat, Dr. Pinheiro.
Hello, Grad Chat.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we're really excited to learn all about the work that you're doing in the lab and outside of the lab as well. But kind of before we dive into your current projects, could you tell us a little bit about kind of your journey so far to your current role and what attracted you to Queen's for research in the first place?
Sure. I'm really happy to be here. It's my second time participating in a podcast, but my first one was actually in Portuguese.
Oh, amazing.
So I think this is a good starting point here. I'm from Brazil, and I came to Queen's to do my PhD a few years ago. And I've been like, it's been such a journey being here, learning so much about not only research, but like human relationships, work ethic, all of that. And I did my PhD in psychology, but I graduated in a program of biology in Brazil. I did like biology with emphasis in teaching. So I did like a, what would be here, like a teacher's college.
Oh, okay, yes.
And I, in the end of my undergrad, I got involved like with research in neuroscience. And that's why I kind of like I transitioned into a master's of neuroscience, which I also completed in Brazil. And then here I entered in the psychology program.
Oh, very nice. So very interdisciplinary approach to your research. So your current research is all about children's sharing behavior online. Can you tell us a little bit about what your projects look like?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because my research was not going to be online, but we all know what happened a few years ago.
Yes, COVID.
Yeah, we are still traumatized about all of this, but that's also what happened with my research. I was not gonna collect data online, for example, but I had to, like a lot of labs around the world actually had to. A question that is really like interesting to social development is how children learn behaviors related to prosociality, which is like doing good for others, like acting in behalf of others. And most of this research was traditionally being conducted in person. And with the pandemic, a lot of researchers with different topics in developmental science started collecting data online. And then two things stood out to me. Like one of them was that, okay, as researchers, we don't know a lot about how behaviors translate or how they like express at all online, especially social behaviors. And the second is, these behaviors already exist. That's it's not a matter of the pandemic being like a thing right now when we having to collect data online. Like, kids are actively sharing with others online, resources like in games, online communities, all of this. And we are not studying enough about that. We don't understand enough. And that's another environment that they are exposed to when they grow up in this environment as well.
Yes, very. I mean, I think a lot of kids have very digital childhoods these days, right? And that's a whole other area that we haven't, well, like you said, we don't have a lot of information on. So your work's kind of looking at that. So you shared a little bit about your research online because of COVID, like many other folks. But what motivated you to study sharing behavior in children? And you hinted towards this already, but why is it so important to look at it in virtual environments?
Yeah, what motivated me, I think, was that, as I said in the beginning, in my biology program, I had the opportunity to do some placements to teach like kids in, not as young as like as I study, but like kids in like middle school and high school. And getting contact with kids like motivated me to study development as well. And my program in Brazil had a really like a really close approach to evolutionary psychology that often has perspective of looking into like comparing development and evolution. So we see, for example, children and like the behaviors that start to develop across time as ways to understand more about us as a species during evolution. So for example, when we talk about sharing, sharing is really like widespread, like in every human community, but it does not happen the same time in every situation. We all know there are so many like little things that make us like, okay, am I gonna share or not with this person? How much? All these things. And this also is affected by different populations and cultures and economic settings, all of this. So the second thing was actually the first thing that motivated me to research was being like coming from an unequal country. So that motivated me to look into how these economic differences could modulate aspects of sharing. As I said, that was my initial motivation when I wanted to start study sharing, but then because I could not collect data online properly and the cross-cultural study that I envisioned having part of my PhD was not super easy to do at first, because of like the problems with like traveling restrictions and like collaborations in general, when just we were like pretty busy with surviving.
Yes. Everything during COVID-19 shifted. Yes. And then to try and propose an international cross-cultural study in two different sites
hard.
In person as a PhD student.
I mean, they
happened.
There were a lot of researchers that did pretty interesting and compelling and important work collaborating, but this study in specific was delayed a little bit. I mean, it happened. I'm going to talk more about it. But at first, we focused on like into the reality that we could like collect data, which was online. We still like explored these economic aspects that I was interested, but there was also the aspect of being in an online environment. That was another question that popped out to us, and it turned out to be a big part of my PhD.
Oh, very cool. Yes, and that's always how research goes, right? Start with one idea and then adjust along the way as different things happen. And sometimes those happen to be a global pandemic, which makes you pivot and change your approach. It sounds like that initial motivation stayed consistent, just the approach and method had to shift a little bit according to lockdown and different things like that.
Yeah, that gave us like opportunity to explore questions that we weren't thinking before. But that are definitely like worth exploring. I think you also in your question you mentioned like why this was important.
Why are virtual environments so important?
So in the virtual environment there are a few aspects that made the same interactions possible but not the same way. Like virtual interactions, they can vary a lot. For example, I can be, imagine that we are here on Zoom, for example, or Google Meet. This would be like a synchronous interaction, like I'm talking to you at this moment, you see what I'm doing, what I'm saying, and everything. But interactions could also be asynchronous, like for example, if we're sending messages, emails, these kinds of things, or even like through pre-recorded stuff. So
sending voice notes or things
exactly.
like that. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, this can, like this synchronicity and the social presence of the interaction can vary in online interactions in a way that like in person not that much.
Yes, in person it wouldn't be quite the same as saying something, pausing, and then waiting until the other person was able to access the voice note in person, right? You're just having a conversation.
Yeah.
There's not things that happen in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also in social behavior, imagine that like a big deal of like interactions and human relationships are also influenced by reputation. So if you see me doing something here, I will feel judged, for example. As I said in the beginning of the of our conversation, I am like ESL, like English as second language person. And like if I say something that is, oh my gosh, I think I didn't say correctly or something, like I'm gonna be a bit, okay, I need to fix that, blah, 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 which is which is silly from me. But this is like the reputation aspect that I'm mentioning. Like with synchronous like interactions, like live interactions, there is more this component of reputation going on. And studies from like in-person settings with kids and adults as well actually show that when we are observed, we share more with others. And we want to appear like more generous, or we don't want others to like think bad of us or something like that. And then having a, like an online interaction, sometimes you don't always feel observed. So that could be something that can modulate. The other thing is that growing up online, kids are also like developing their cognitive abilities to interact with the screen. And resources are not perceived the same way in a screen or in person. And this was a big point in my research that gave me a lot of headache to analyze data, actually. I can talk more about that later, but basically these two aspects, like how kids would like over time interact with virtual resources and be willing or not to like share with others in an online environment. And if like the differences in the observation or like the synchronicity of the interaction would interfere with the way that kids were like deciding as well.
Oh, that's super interesting. And you mentioned, you were explaining like how perceptions of standing or your reputation are impacted. So how do children's perceptions of their own social status or their own understanding of their reputation influence how they share? And did anything surprise you about what you found?
Yeah, definitely. So studies with like taking a look at this, like at how economic status, and status can be like, for example, coming from a more, you did something, you did better than me, so like you're above me in this like context here, like for example, I don't know, playing volleyball or something like that. But in this case, like status that we're talking about is comes from like economics itself, like for example, comparison of education level or comparison of annual income, let's say, like a official, let's put like on course, like government kind of mark. And from that standpoint, a lot of research has explored objective status. So the difference is that objective status is the one that uses these kind of measures, like for example, income, education, that are like official measures. But that can shift from what people perceive as their status. For example, I could be in an environment that is so unequal that I don't perceive that I am like not like in the gradient of like income, for example. I'm not in the middle. I'm like way lower, for example. Or that I'm in the middle and I think that I'm way higher, something like that. So social standing, like there are these two types of measures. And one of them is the subjective way of looking at things. That's what I mentioned, like the perception.
So like if, how everyone thinks they're middle class, regardless of what their income is. If you ask someone, they say, oh, where are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm middle class, whether or not they fit. You
what
know.
Middle class?
Exactly. Yes. Like where that. Does that fit? But so people's perception of where they are versus those official markers, like what shows up on your income tax or what shows up.
Perfect.
Yes. That kind of thing. Okay. Yeah. No, it makes sense.
Research has focused much more on like creating an artificial status, like I was talking at you, like being better at a task or I don't know, like, okay, you're gonna be middle class today, you're gonna be high class, something like that, like manipulating the status markers or using the objective, like asking questionnaires and asking people to like put their annual income, for example, but has not focused that much even in adults with subjective status. And subjective feelings can be more like research, which is like pretty recent, by the way, but research has been showing that subjective status can actually sometimes be more informative about a few social behaviors, because it can like deal with the feelings that the person have of like, for example, pride, merit, deservingness, all these kinds of things. And also how like people decide to share because they are immersed in like in a community that's interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to look into subjective status exactly because it's understudied, especially in mm-hmm. children. And it has an interesting pattern of development in children. So children mm-hmm. in the beginning, like when they're young, they think they are in a much higher status than they are.
mm-hmm.
So if you ask a small child, like a young child, okay, where do you think you are here? Like if you present, for example, the paradigm of MacArthur, which is like a ladder and there are 10 rungs mm-hmm. and ask them, okay, imagine that this is the society
mm-hmm.
and people like in the bottom rung, they would have like jobs that pay less, they had less things. And then people in the top rung would be like the best off, like with the best jobs, better reputation, all these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Usually young children, they are like, oh, I'm the top, of course.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this can be due to the fact that they have less perspectives on wealth in general.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to like understand what they have, what others have, what they don't have, things like that. So research by scholars like Rebecca Peretz-Lange mm-hmm. and Tara Mandalaiwala has shown that kids, they have this like this higher perspective actually as with a young age. And some researchers, like for example, Dorsa Emir, has shown that this type of paradigm, when it's like shown to kids, they show a really interesting pattern like through development, which is like an inverse relationship between age and subjective social status.
Mm.
So we found the exact same thing and we adapted that paradigm. Like we did something more like, I mean, it's still graphical, like mm-hmm. the ladder thing that I mentioned, but we transformed into like little houses of increasing sizes.
Okay.
And then we found the exact same pattern, like kids younger than 7-8 years old, they have a pretty optimistic way to see their own status. And then as they pass through middle childhood, which is also an important landmark mm. for sharing, they start to be a bit more realistic about the status.
Mm. They start to see their perspective aligned, their subjective perspective aligns more with maybe some of those objective markers as they age.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. With this kind of developing sense of status that kids are creating for themselves, what does this mean for their sharing or their sharing behavior?
Yeah, this is like, I think, like in my personal opinion, mm-hmm. the most interesting finding mm. of my PhD. We found that by analyzing like the way that kids were like giving in this game that we created and using this perception of status as a predictor, like to try to like find where the relationship was mm. going, like in terms of like how they perceive status and how they're sharing them. We found that actually there is sort of an inverse relationship.
Mm.
So kids that were perceiving themselves as having more, they gave less in the game.
Oh, interesting.
And less equitably as well. So equitably, we consider like giving half of the resources. For example, we have 10 resources, like 10 golden coins in this game that we created. And being equitable would mean like giving 5, for example. And this would be like towards someone who is like with them, like an experimenter who's like interacting with them live. Mm. Or with a pre-recorded adults that's like interacting with them as well. So we created these two conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that like kids that were observed, like that were like interacting directly with the adult experimenter, they shared more.
Mm.
So these also corroborated something that we found online. And kids that had lower status, like shared more coins. And kids that had higher status shared less. So this is what I found on my PhD. Then, as I mentioned, that like I was interested in doing this international collaboration, mm-hmm. especially because we think that aspects of perception of status and inequality might be different in places that have high inequality.
Mm.
And then we collaborated with two universities in Brazil. One was the one that I did my undergrad, which was really fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And also another university, so it would be Universidade Federal do Rio Grande do Norte in the northeast of Brazil. And Universidade Federal do Pará, which would be in the north, close to the Amazon forest.
Okay.
So we had kids from like diverse socioeconomic status participating. I mean, also here in Canada, we got a bit more of diversity than what we usually get with like in-person studies.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more, not that much. In Brazil, we also had like different statuses, but that was constrained by the fact that families needed to have internet access.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like also, there was diversity, but we could have more. So for that reason, maybe we need to interpret these results as well, thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But we found the same relationship in Brazil.
Interesting.
So also kids in Brazil that perceive themselves as higher status also shared less in our game. So it's cool to see that like a behavior in like a specific environment is already like capturing a few aspects of society, could be capturing a few aspects of society and was observed like cross-culturally.
Oh, that's very interesting. Especially, yes, so I wonder how kids are learning this, right? Like, and I'm sure, I know you've got lots of ideas for future studies coming up. And what does this tell us about how children develop pro-social behavior then, if they they start to build an understanding of maybe where their status, their family status truly lies? What does that tell us about how they're developing?
Yeah, this is super interesting because we all know that like young kids, they have a hard time sharing with others. And this is normal because there is something that develops through time, which is inequity aversion. And this aspect is like the first thing that develops is like the disadvantageous version of inequity aversion. So you being adverse, like you being like, okay, I don't like that about you being in disadvantage. Like even animals show that. Like if people like did experiments, like Michael Tomasello, for example, did experiments, and kids and chimps were like really like not happy about the fact that they received less snacks or less stickers, for example. And they were able to see like, for example, that other child or chimp received more than them and be not happy about it. But then like something interesting happens in middle childhood. Like, of course, all the things come into play. Like, for example, reputation that I mentioned, like around 5 years of age, kids start to like be aware of their actions and try to look better for others, not only with sharing, but other types of prosocial behavior, like helping and like comforting others, for example. But around middle childhood, something interesting happens that is absorbing social norms. So people start to like, okay, I need to act like the adults of my society, what is considered the correct thing, because this is fair. So this is like the advantageous inequity aversion like starts to be true here, like starts to be the thing, because kids start to feel bad about receiving more than others. Not in every situation, but like spontaneously. Because before that, like before middle childhood, usually kids are only like equitable. They're only like sharing the same amounts is correct when they like are prompted by adults or by older kids, for example. I mean, hey, you should share more with your little brother.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Yes. I think a lot of listeners who have, you know, young children in their lives can definitely appreciate what you're saying and see that, can see that happening in their interactions. So they start to shift and absorb, like you said, the norms of adults. So they start to change and they're worried about how they're perceived by others, if they're being perceived as good or bad or generous or not generous, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we knew all of that from like in-person research. And there was little evidence at the time. Nowadays, there is more because there was more like research conducted online because of the pandemic as well. But there was little evidence on like how these behaviors expressed in the online environment. Exactly because of the things that I talked about, like there is less observation, like less reputation cues in some types of interaction. But also because things like the way that kids perceive these resources that they want or not, like in a screen, are different from what they would have like with tangible resources, for example.
For example, like it's a lot harder for, or correct me if I'm wrong, but a kid with candy, for example, right in front of them understands quite quickly what that is and what that resource might be. But online sharing tokens or whatever online currency might not translate the same to their understanding of value compared to something that's right in front of them that they can immediately touch and access or snack on in the case of candy, that kind of thing. Is that correct?
Yeah, things start to be more real when kids start to like interact more within online worlds, like for example in video games. So for example, I'm playing a video game and like having this like fun and like engaging interaction, you start to like value these resources. So in neuroeconomics there is, and in economics as well, of course, there is this valuation aspect that's like how much this matters to you. And that might be a thing in our study that was a limitation, actually, that we weren't able to measure how much their young kids were like valuing these resources and opened up as well questions for further research. How much that was impacting the way that they chose to share, because what we've seen in our research was that in person there is like usually a line that like increases over time of how much children are sharing, so a linear positive relationship. And what we saw was a U-shaped relationship.
Mm.
So young kids that usually don't share a lot of like candy stickers or tokens, even in person, like in laboratory or naturalistic settings, they were like, for some reason, giving out a lot.
Oh, interesting.
Of tokens mm-hmm. in our study. So what we did was that we created a video game
mm-hmm.
in our lab that's actually I programmed and illustrated this
oh,
video game.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
Which can also showcase that like sometimes in psychology, you can like apply many different, I mean, in science in general, you can apply and transfer different skills mm-hmm. to make different things work for your research. But we created a video game in which kids completed activities. They gained these tokens that we told them they could like buy a prize at the end
mm.
in a virtual store.
Mm-hmm.
So we did our best to like control for how much kids have interacted in the past with tokens or online currencies by asking questions about these types of things in the mm-hmm. questionnaire for parents. But also we try to like sell these coins and say that like, oh, they're great. Like you're going to buy these types of prizes in the end. Do you want to play? And they're like, oh, of course. And all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like, this question remained to us because the young kids in the online settings, they were giving more coins than what we expected.
Mm.
And this is something that I said that was a nightmare to analyze,
mm-hmm.
exactly because that's not the pattern that we usually find in mm-hmm. developmental studies. So we were like, okay, here we have something different.
Mm-hmm.
We have a few, like, hypotheses on why this is happening, but it's definitely different from in person.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And then you said it was a U-curve, so I assume that means younger children are sharing a lot, and then it decreases as they
yes.
age, and then increases again at another certain age point?
Mm-hmm. So around 6 years old, like, they have this dip.
Okay.
In the curve. And then they start again, like, around, like, 8, like, middle childhood, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
That aspect, we could, like, argument at this point that was due, for example, for absorption of social norms.
Mm.
And that makes sense and something that we corroborated in the online environment, which was really cool. But the pattern of young kids was still, like, mesmerizing to us.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, we have a few hypothesis on why this happened. It can be due to the valuation aspect that I mentioned, that these young kids, they don't understand well yet
mm-hmm.
the value of these coins in an online environment, or can be due to like more cognitive aspects of planning and understanding that a 2D thing that's on a screen values something.
Yes, they haven't quite. Perhaps the abstract value is hard for them to conceptualize at that point. Would that be?
Yeah.
Yes.
Also that, but even like understanding that these quantities in a screen are the same quantities of something, like if the tokens, real tokens existed mm-hmm. in front of them. So there can be other reasons for sure. And that's something that we are interested in, like taking a better look at it now and like writing about it as well, because there's not a lot of research done on how kids conceptualize digital currencies.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of research on that is on user experience, actually, on like computation, but it's more like exploratory
okay.
in a sense of like having, for example, a group of kids interacting with like a software or like a currency, and then like doing a report on how these kids explore, which is super valid.
Mm-hmm.
But from the psychology perspective, we also need to design some studies to better understand how this, like, understanding, like, how this conceptualization of digital currencies happen and learning about its value.
Oh, that's very interesting because, I mean, so much of what we're doing is in the virtual world these days.
Mm-hmm.
So why does understanding sharing in virtual contexts matter for the broader world? And what implications might your research have beyond the lab?
Yeah, so research like that can inform, for example, how we can think and start to design online applications.
Mm.
First of all, like seeing the media thing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, because we're seeing that the young kids are not understanding currency the same way,
mm-hmm.
probably not understanding currency the same way as the older kids. And then by designing like educational applications and video games and communities and things that are like, for example, extensions of the classroom or like practice for them with like digital abilities and all of this. And just video games in general, maybe things that are like designed for younger kids need to be designed in a different manner for them to understand the value that things have.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, like in a broader sense to the society, we could see like that, like how these perceptions of status within social communities online already are unfolding, could be unfolding, like different ways in what people are like interacting as kids, and that they like perpetuate these patterns for a lot of years and get to the adult life, and how we can like design interventions, education interventions, or like parenting interventions as well for kids, in the sense of like thinking about building societies with more fairness, for example.
No, it makes a lot of sense. Well, Sylvia, it has been so great chatting with you. Thank you for doing the show, and best of luck with the rest of your research as you continue to explore.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Questions, and
thank you so much.
So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM. Grad Chat.
Hi, I'm Steve Swellsy-Wells, and I'm extraordinarily excited to invite you to Gannspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th at the Royal Theatre in Gananoque. Come rock out with MC Shansky.